Welcome to MBA Podcaster, the only broadcast source for cutting-edge information and advice on the MBA application process. I'm Janet Nakano. Business schools are working hard to increase the number of minorities into their programs, targeting mainly Hispanics, African Americans, Native Americans, and women. But progress is slow. Studies say minorities make up only 7% of top MBA programs, compared to about 15% at top medical and law schools. Meanwhile, women typically make up less than a third of a class. This time, we'll talk about what holds back minorities and women from pursuing an MBA, and we'll also go over the variety of resources and programs available for minorities. You'll hear from a dean, two women MBA students, and the heads of a couple MBA outreach organizations. In today's multicultural, national, and multilingual market, it's no wonder top companies are looking to diversify their staff. Business schools are motivated too. They've teamed up with outreach organizations to offer information sessions, seminars, scholarships, and fellowships just for minorities. According to AACSB International, the business school accrediting organization, only 5% of U.S. MBA students are Hispanic Americans, while less than 2% of business school professors are Hispanics. Stephanie Herrera is Denver chapter president of the National Society of Hispanic MBAs. The organization has over 6,000 members and 29 chapters in the U.S. and Puerto Rico. Herrera says the main reason why Hispanics don't pursue an MBA is because of the lack of financial aid.
Because everybody knows when you get up into the higher graduate degrees, there's not a lot of financial aid. You get much more support, especially from the government and at an undergraduate level. If you go through the traditional financial aid system, Pell Grants, they don't give you Pell Grants for an MBA. So a lot of times people are very dependent upon that system when they are going for their undergraduate degree, and then when they go for their master's, they don't see a lot of financing options besides student loans. So then with the National Society of Hispanic MBAs, one of our jobs is to help them find the resources and to give away scholarships. This year we gave away $1 million in scholarships.
The Consortium for Graduate Study in Management awards more than 350 minority fellowships each year. The National Black MBA Association also has scholarships available. Herrera says it's not just that MBAs are tough to afford. Hispanics and other underrepresented minorities don't have a clear sense of what a business degree will bring.
A lot of families who haven't had access to the education system always question, why do you need this education? You're losing money. You're working part-time. Where is it going to get you in the future? But a lot of times people don't know what the financial impact can have once they do receive their MBAs.
It's obvious that when you go to medical school, you become a doctor. But it's not so easy to say that when you go to business school, you become a businessman or woman. You could be an investment banker, lead a nonprofit organization, or start your own business. Keisha Don Ensminger is founder and executive director of MBA Diversity, an organization that supports present and future multicultural business professionals. Ensminger says having role models for minorities is key.
When I was applying to B school, that was definitely one of the concerns was, okay, well, where are the mentors and the role models to kind of effectively articulate to us what opportunities are available out there? You know, you see the IB people coming, you see the MC people coming, of course, investment banking and management consulting people coming to recruit, general management roles, but you didn't necessarily see, you know, the varied opportunities that there are out there. Not everyone wants to take on those traditional roles. So I definitely think that's one of the challenges that we're facing today that MBA Diversity is trying to fill with our national symposium. It's just basically trying to communicate all of the different opportunities that there are out there for people who have their MBAs.
Despite strides made through various outreach programs, still Hispanics, African Americans, and American Indians are scarce at the top, leaving minority youth to wonder how they can become an executive or if it's even possible. That's why Mentoring Young Minorities is an important program at the National Society of Hispanic MBAs, says Stephanie Herrera. She's currently mentoring 10 undergraduate students.
Make sure that they study for the GMAT, help them with the GMAT questions, help them with their entrance exam essays, finding scholarships, financial aid. It runs the gamut. I mean, for undergraduate students looking at obtaining their MBAs, we took them to MIT, and it was just very awesome what happened to them, because a lot of them didn't even know about an MBA or what an MBA could do for them. So it's very interesting. I have one very good success story. He was going to go to Paris with his graduation money, and he decided to not go to Paris, and he decided to spend his money on a GMAT preparation course and to travel to the colleges to see where he wanted to go to school.
And is he going to an MBA program now?
We're in the process of choosing where he wants to go to school, but he never knew he had the options. He never knew MIT wanted him or that he could go to these other colleges. And it's just wonderful to see what happened to these students, because they're applying for all these Ivy League schools and other colleges.
Getting a good score on the GMAT is yet another barrier for minorities, says Herrera.
We aren't necessarily 100% in math or 100% in science, or haven't been groomed as our competition for these MBA programs to say, hey, I'm going to go to Harvard, MIT, Stanford. You know, a lot of times we find that students such as myself, you know, I didn't know when I started my college career I was going to complete my MBA.
The National Society of Hispanic MBAs offers programs to help with the GMAT. MBA Diversity also offers GMAT scholarships. Stay tuned at the end of this show to hear an interview with Veritas Prep, a GMAT preparatory provider. You'll hear their recommendations for acing the GMAT. Veritas is also offering a special $150 discount on their test prep services to MBA podcaster listeners by using the code POD150 when registering for classes. A women's student organization at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College called Tuck Women in Business provides networking and mentoring opportunities as well as career development support and hosts an annual conference. Sonali Agarwal is co-chairwoman.
Throughout the year, we will sponsor female executives and leaders to visit Tuck. In addition, we'll have different panels and dinners with different companies, with different industries. And the real purpose of the organization is to really provide a forum for women to really get career development advice and professional development and really reach out to alums as well. One program that we actually reinstated this year is a mentoring program. And in that program, what we do is we match all current students with alumni who have graduated in the past 10 years. And we match them according to interests and anything else on any other factor which we think that they might be able to connect upon. In addition, something else that we'd like to do eventually is also network with other business schools. We feel that business schools in general tend to do a lot of networking within our own school, but we think it'd be a great forum to actually reach out to women and other students in other business schools as well and really have another networking opportunity to do that.
Do you think that it's important for women to be involved in an organization like yours?
Absolutely. I think it, as women, we obviously have different issues than men do when it comes to careers and stuff like that. Like families is kind of a big thing that we have to deal with that men necessarily don't, interrupting our careers. So I think in that sense, having this organization is really important. It provides a support network.
Tuck's incoming class this year included the highest ever number of women at 33%. Most business schools average around 30% women, compared to law school or medical school, where women average right around half. Tuck's dean, Paul Danos.
They say the theory is for women that because we require experience and because the average age is 27, that by the time they get out at 29, that is getting close to some limits in terms of their biological clock and having families. That's a theory. I'm not saying I espouse that because I don't really know. I don't have the empirical evidence that that is the causal factor. That's one factor that people think can be playing here, because women are 50% of the undergraduate majors in business. Many, many schools have undergraduate majors in business, and it's 50% women. So why is it only 33% in the MBA? A lot of people say it's because by age 30, a woman has to decide if they're going to, you know, have a family in the traditional way, in the sense of staying home with them. And then, you know, what good is the MBA if you're going to be having a family? And what I say is the vast majority of women will find a way to make that work and go get back to work within a reasonable period of time, and then they're going to want to be back on track.
Tuck has launched its 11-day Back in Business program aimed at returning professionals. Pepperdine University as well is starting up a program in January to accommodate the schedules of at-home moms and others called Morning MBA. Again, Dean Danos.
I think often the culture and society, once they have a family, the culture and society puts pressure on them to stay home. And I think the companies don't have good systems for giving them flexible ways of staying on track. And therefore, often they'll drop out, and then they want to come back later. And so that, I think that's the pattern that you see. And I think it does depress to some extent the number of women that want to get in at age 28 because they see that coming. And so I think there's a couple of things that could be done, but the most important thing is for the employers of these fast-track companies and these high-level companies who hire MBAs to create systems that are more flexible in those mid-years, those years in the 30s. That's the place where the most improvement could be made. There's still going to be people that are going to want to stay home with families in our culture. There's no doubt about that. But there are many that would, if they could be flexible for a while, I think they would take that too.
On campus at Tuck, women are the minority. But Tuck's Women in Business co-chair Hillary Halper says she doesn't notice the imbalance so much.
I think that you may notice a difference in that some of the males are more prone to speak up, more in class, especially in the first year. I think that changes as, you know, we all get to know each other and feel more comfortable. And, you know, as I've gone into my second year, I think it's more equal. Everybody's speaking up in class. I think that even though there may be fewer women, the kind of the force that we have on campus is very strong. You know, there are a lot of females in charge of many of the different clubs, and, you know, we're a strong presence on campus. So, even though the numbers may be a little lopsided, you know, I don't feel as though I'm in a male-dominated world up here.
Just over 16% of Fortune 500 companies have women as corporate officers. That's according to Catalyst, a leading researcher of women in the workplace. And only 11 Fortune 500 CEOs are women. Dean Paul Danos says the low numbers could be tied to the idea that business isn't compatible with family life.
It certainly isn't that they don't get the same opportunities. Last year, our women got exactly the same jobs as our men in terms of salaries and opportunities. They the first few years in employment are exactly the same. And so it's not that it isn't a fact that they don't get the same opportunities or they have the same satisfaction level with the school. So there's no significant difference between the way men feel about the MBA program and their experience and women feel about it. So it isn't, those aren't the factors. It's something to do with the perception of the career, I think, and perhaps it has something to do with, is this compatible with family life? Now, why would medicine and law be considered compatible when those professions require just as many hours at work and just as much time away from the family as does business? I'm not sure why that perception is there, but it seems to be there.
MBA Diversity's Keisha Don Ensminger says the reason for the low number of top women executives could be that women are going for other types of positions.
I think women are headed for more fulfilling roles, not necessarily executive roles. The quote-unquote green movement that we're in now, you know, focusing on a triple bottom line, social sustainability, you're seeing a lot of women focusing on non-traditional corporations and opportunities, particularly in the nonprofit realm. So I can't really speak to how the executive pipeline is filling, but I can say that definitely in the non-traditional nonprofit realm, that definitely is seeing an increase.
Tuck's Women in Business co-chair Hillary Halper says the number of top women execs will likely increase in the coming years. Sonali Agarwal could be one example.
Women moving into top positions, that would have meant that 20 years ago, they would have had to be on that track. And I think that things have changed significantly in recent years and that, you know, moving forward, we will see more and more women going into those executive positions just because of the way things are today. and that, you know, more women are being encouraged to take on leadership roles.
I would love to be the head of a Fortune 500 company. So yeah, absolutely. It's something I'm striving for.
Stay tuned to listen to an interview with Veritas Prep, a GMAT preparatory provider. You'll hear their recommendations for acing the GMAT. Veritas is also offering a special $150 discount on their test prep services to MBA podcaster listeners by using the code POD150 when registering for classes. For more information, advice, and to register for your weekly MBA podcast, visit mbapodcaster.com. I'm Janet Nakano, and this is MBA Podcaster. Thanks for listening. And next time, we'll learn how to put those finishing touches on your application. I'm Janet Nakano from MBA Podcaster, and today we're giving you a look at the GMAT through the eyes of one of the leading GMAT preparatory programs, Veritas Prep. Veritas offers GMAT courses in more than 60 cities around the world. It offers 42 hours of class time. Its instructors have all scored in the 99th percentile, and close to a third of alumni score 700 or better. If you want to apply to business school, the GMAT is likely a necessary step. And if you want to go to a top MBA program, you'll be competing with those with high scores. Veritas Prep instructors deconstruct the GMAT by question types and key concepts and teach specific strategies that they say can boost scores by 120 points on average. We'll hear from Veritas Prep founder Chad Troutwine. We'll also visit a Veritas class where we'll meet an instructor and hear from a current student. An alumnus will share how much he benefited from the course, and you'll even walk away with several GMAT tips that can possibly increase your score. Be sure to stay tuned to hear about an exclusive discount that Veritas Prep is offering to MBA Podcaster listeners.
The seminar is designed as a way to sort of expose to you what you will face when you actually take the GMAT, let you know a little bit about the Veritas course, and to help give you a more informed decision about when you want to take the test, what kind of test prep options are going to fit for you.
Chad Troutwine is co-founder of Veritas Prep. He's leading a GMAT seminar at their Los Angeles classroom location.
The free seminar is not necessarily designed to have you leave a better test taker. However, we're going to spend about 10 minutes. And if you focus hard in that 10 minutes, you really master it, your test score will likely go up about 20 points before you leave. So it's kind of a nice little bonus. Just a little something for you. You're nice enough to come out here. We're just going to give you the 20 points on the extra 20 points in the GMAT. You know, and it can really make a difference. Maybe you can squeeze out 30. The difference in 30 points can be dramatic. The average GMAT score at Harvard last year was a 707. The average GMAT score at, no one went to the University of Florida, right? Good school. You know, look at what they're doing in athletics. Crazy. National championships in football and basketball in the same season. But, you know, if you're thinking, but it's still probably not a top MBA program, you'd be right. It's ranked about 45th in the country. Well, their average GMAT score is still a 675.
Troutwine himself scored extraordinarily well on the GMAT. He has a JD as well as an MBA from Yale. And it was soon after graduating from Yale that he and a classmate decided to launch Veritas Prep. Here at today's seminar, Troutwine explains to a group of MBA hopefuls how the GMAT works.
The GMAT used to work like most standardized exams, and that is every student that takes the test at a similar time faces the exact same questions. And you are graded based on how many questions you score relative to how the other people do on the test. Those raw scores are then converted into percentiles. Those percentiles are then uniform. So you have a rough gauge to compare someone who took a standardized exam in 1985 versus someone who took it last year. The GMAT is a little different. It's adaptive, meaning if we all went in and took the test the exact same moment in different cities across the country, we would all have different questions that we would face. So different, in fact, it would be unlikely that any one of us would even share a similar question. Their pool of questions numbers more than several thousand, both quant and verbal, all range by difficulty and the length of time each question on average requires for a student to solve. And so what happens is we roll in. And so the computer, the algorithm, I'm now going to kind of make it like it's a person. The computer thinks that you're all going to get right around a 537. It treats all of us the same. We roll in, and it's just assuming you're going to be like everybody else and kind of be right in the middle. Your answers then influence the computer's opinion of how you're going to do, and the test changes accordingly. It's really kind of fascinating. So if I roll in and I get five consecutive correct answer choices, now the computer thinks, I've got someone who's going to do well in the test. Let's see how well he will do. And it will then start submitting increasingly more difficult questions until I miss one. So it punishes me, but rewards me by giving me a higher score. So and on the chart, that would match up to the sort of top bar. So we start all like right around 500, as I said, 537. So I get one correct. Say I get a few correct. The test will give me increasingly more difficult questions, but my score goes up. If I keep getting them right, my score can climb all the way up to an 800. But I have to keep getting them right, and the questions are going to continue to be very difficult. Conversely, if I go in there and I have a sluggish start, and I start missing a few, well, the test kind of feels sorry for me and starts lobbing in softballs. Come on, buddy. You can do it. And they just get increasingly easy. But my score drops accordingly, as it should. I'm not getting any questions right. By the end of the 37 quant questions and the end of the 41 verbal questions, the Graduate Management Admissions Council believes their algorithm has sort of locked in on your ability. And you're then given a score, a raw score first based on the number of questions and the difficulty level of those questions and the percentile relative to the other test takers. Okay, and that's your GMAT score.
Your GMAT score is just one piece of a whole puzzle, says Troutwine, but it's an important piece, especially if you want to be competitive for the top programs. The GMAT is similar to other standardized exams like the SAT and GRE, and he says it's pretty straightforward.
You start with an interactive tutorial that no Veritas student would sit through because you'll have already done many, many practice GMAT exams, and you certainly understand how to work through it. It's very simple. If you've been on a computer and you've sort of worked through any application, it's simple point and click with a mouse. It's very intuitive and straightforward. The first portion of the test is the analytical writing assessment. It is a scored set of essays. That portion of the test is scored on a pretty simple format from 6.0, that's the best score, all the way down to 0. 2.0s and 1.0s, that would be like just above functional illiteracy. What happens is when you take the AWA, you want to make sure that your score is high enough not to arouse any suspicion that you would struggle writing an exam. It's not an area where you really gain strength or improve your candidacy during the application process, but it is a place where you could undermine your candidacy if you woefully underperform. If you get a really high score, that's great. And what's nice is with Veritas, you will. We have a foolproof template that creates a support matrix and set of tools that you'll be able to master in class and roll in knowing that you'll have a way to attack the AWA and get a high score. For those of you that already have evidence that you can write under pressure, either based on your major or your work, you have no fears. Now let's get to the more important scored portions of the test. We have an optional 10-minute break. If you choose to take that optional break, the clock starts, and it's an actual clock that ticks, and so, or it counts down on the computer. So if you go to the restroom or take your break, if you come back 11, 12 minutes later, you'll be 2 minutes into the scored section. So you want to be careful about that. The quantitative portion of the test is always 37 questions. It is always 75 minutes. You will always face 22 problem-solving questions, and you will always face 15 data sufficiency questions. You have another optional break, which is sometimes a good way to sort of refresh yourself and get focused on your next task, which is the verbal portion of the test. Again, it is always it's standardized. It's always 41 questions, and again, the length is always 75 minutes.
One of the listeners, you can receive a $150 discount on any Veritas GMAT course, private tutoring, or MBA admission school package by registering at Veritas Prep with the code POD150. That's POD150. Learn more at veritasprep.com. Rob Howell recently took the GMAT after completing the 7-week-long Veritas course. He's currently working in a rotational program at Boeing, and he says he's planning on applying to business school next year.
I'm originally from Oklahoma. I went to school in Malibu, California at Pepperdine University. It's a little bit of a change of scenery. Studied international business. My very first GMAT that I took was just a practice test. and I scored a 580. Wasn't particularly happy with that score, especially considering my goals and my past performance, so I knew I had to do something. I did quite a bit of research on the different programs offered. Having taken the LSAT while I was still in school, I know how important it is to have, more than anything, it's the teacher. And I think a lot of people that I talk to could agree with that and can attest to that, because if you have a boring instructor or somebody that you just can't connect with, it can really be disastrous. The reason why now I'm such a believer in Veritas is because of the instructor. My first day, I show up and find out this guy aced his GMAT, has a master's degree in education, and just has tons of energy, and it's contagious. So I slowly improved my score, peaked around 700, and when I actually took my GMAT, I got a 680. I guess the most realistic schools that I'd really like to apply to and plan to apply to are the Anderson School at UCLA and SOM at Yale.
That weekend course, the last 2 weekends in July, you're more than welcome to come into that. So
it's 7 o'clock on a Thursday, and alumnus Rob Howell's instructor is teaching tonight. Brian Galvin has been a Veritas instructor since 2003. He is, as Rob said, full of energy, and tonight is the final day of class.
Talked a couple times about running marathons. I think the GMAT's a lot like that. The night before you run a marathon, you start thinking about, I wish I would have been able to do one more 20-miler. I wish I would have gotten a couple more speed workouts in. I wish I would have had an extra week to taper. I might be a little bit tired. But it doesn't matter, because that alarm clock's going off the next day and you have to run, so you know you have to make the best of it. Same thing with the GMAT. I think if you asked anyone who's serious about running a marathon, when's the optimal date to do it, they'd all think about, well, if I pushed it off 6 weeks, I'd get a little more training in, and then a weekend trip would come up in the middle of it, and they'd push it off and eventually be in worse shape for adding 6 weeks on. Same thing with the GMAT. If you push it off too far, you've gone through 7 weeks of regimented training for now. If you know you want one more fresher, maybe sign up for August, but should start thinking about putting a day together now so that you're accountable to it. So, first time I ever taught the class, my second lesson that I taught was arithmetic, and it was in Detroit, and it was a room full of automotive engineers. I was the youngest guy in the room, and I needed to teach them addition, subtraction, fractions, and was actually pretty intimidated by it, but found that a lot of people just need to relearn those rules, those technicalities, and even some of those skills that we take for granted when we move on to other things. And so our course is designed that we build from basic skills. Don't assume that anyone knows anything, you know, at least not everything they need to know about the test, or don't assume that everyone knows every skill. And by going through all those step by step, we give everyone a week to do homework, come back and discuss it at the beginning of the next class. We'll do our verbal lessons the first day each week, the quant lessons the second day each week, and that way they can come back, build on those skills, and then we can move on to more advanced things. Find that that's helpful for a lot of people just to get regimented to study again. People that have been out of school for 5, 10, even more years, just the being in a classroom and taking notes, I think takes a little time to get acclimated to finding a study rhythm. And so therefore, when they start to hit their stride and pick up those basic skills by the second, third week, we're really ready to take off and hit some difficult applications, and people tend to be comfortable moving on to the next step.
Like all Veritas instructors, Galvin scored in the 99th percentile of the GMAT. He took the test straight out of college, but decided not to get an MBA and instead focus on teaching. He appears to be one of those rare breeds gifted in standardized testing.
Brian's awesome. Brian's like, he's a Jedi master, basically, of the GMAT.
That's current student Ken Kasakian.
He breaks it down. I mean, just try Brian. Throw a question at him and see. Yeah, he's awesome. Veritas was the only one that was like a scientific, analytical machine in breaking down, like, what's going to be asked. And so that was obviously the better choice in that regard. They really are invested in why you're going to business school and helping you basically ultimately get there. So it's not just kind of, you know, the run-of-the-mill, like, take our course and then, you know, we'll guarantee you a certain point increase. They teach from the perspective of where you're going to be and why you're involved in this arduous and, you know, traumatic process of studying for the GMAT.
Just a great example of sort of that overall GMAT concept of making the math as simple as you can make it.
Back in class, Brian Galvin is reminding his students that extensive calculations are rarely required on the exam, Like in this problem, asking to multiply a series of decimals.
If you've started multiplying decimals, you're on a long road toward frustration and eventual burnout. What's the best way to attack this one? Use fractions whenever possible. Division problems should be fractions. Decimals, whenever you can, convert them to fractions. Any of these seem easy enough to convert right away? So 0.333 is 1/3. 0.1667 is 1/6. And remember, we don't need to memorize all of these. Hopefully you have, but if you don't, if you see 0.1667, you know that it's a decimal. They don't want you multiplying four digits. And so you know that it can be converted to a fraction. Take a look. It looks like it's about half of 0.3333. If you do a quick mental math, it is. And so it's half of 1/3, which makes it 1/6. This one is 1/8. This one is 2/3.
I think on the quantitative side, having gone through the quantitative review lesson tonight, the biggest key for students to keep in mind is that there's a finite amount of material that's testable on the GMAT. You won't be tested on things that are obscure or intensive calculations, anything like that. The biggest key to success on the GMAT is understanding exactly what you're responsible for knowing, the things we go through in our course, and then being able to find those testable concepts in any type of question that seems to be obscure or overtly difficult. A lot of times with students, particularly with geometry questions, if you can't find a circle, triangle, or basic quadrilateral, if that's not the shape being tested, there will be one of those in there if you draw a diagonal through a shape or take the area of that shape or anything like that. And for most people, being able to see the concepts that they know, even when a question might seem difficult, that's where you need to get started. And the GMAT tries to obscure those key concepts in a number of ways, but those concepts will always be what's being tested. So you don't want to fall into the distractions of a shape that looks awkward or a question that seems worded in a convoluted way. If you look exactly for the skill that you know you've worked through and the concept that you know is testable, begin with that and you'll find that the rest is just distractions to keep you away from the matter at hand. On the verbal side, the idea of key concepts, I think, is just as important as it is on the quantitative side and sometimes overlooked by people. I think one type of question that students tend to overlook the difficulty with or do in the way that just feels natural is reading comprehension passages. The GMAT wants to give difficult material and write it in a way in which they sort of obscure what's really being tested. And a lot of students who are successful in other walks of life are successful because of their attention to detail. On the GMAT, you want to pay attention to detail, but only the detail you're responsible for. And a lot of people will find that it's helpful to anchor themselves not by technical terminology or anything that's not testable, but by transition language. And if you can find words such as however, conversely, or moreover and furthermore, then you know how their argument's being constructed, and you'll be able to look for the first part of the argument flowing into the second or the first part transitioning into a rebuttal. And a lot of people make the mistake of getting caught up in the subject matter when really more often than not, it's the structure of the passage and not the content of the passage that's really important to be able to answer the questions that follow.
Oddly, I think it's a calendar month, which doesn't seem to make sense, but there's some limitations.
Back at the GMAT seminar, Chad Troutwine is explaining how Veritas deconstructs the GMAT.
One of the things that we try and do is help you think like the test maker. We talked about sort of the job of the GMAT. It's to understand your analytical abilities, get a sense of your ability to work with math. And all that matters. I mean, business school is pretty difficult, and the top schools is really difficult. And it's very quantitative. You're not already gone through law school. And psychologically, I think law school is more grim than business school. But make no mistake, at the top business schools, it's very competitive, and they don't want to bring anyone in who can't handle the work. So the GMAT, even though it's annoying and it's flawed, and it's only a measure of one very narrow thing, it's not a bad test as far as standardized exams go. And then we also try and show you how the GMAT, or the makers of the GMAT, will design trapdoors. They will try and get you to do the wrong thing. We show you how they elicit wrong answers, in other words. Let's sort of get on the other side of the desk for a minute. They want to try and sort of distinguish a big group of people. So we can look at your grades, we can look at your previous work experience. Let's look at this analytical ability. If everything were very straightforward, scores would be inflated and would be harder to distinguish between people. So what they do is they try and create traps. sort of tricks to get you to fall through a trap door, and that can be done in a variety of different ways. One of the reasons why I've done so well on standardized exams, I'll just tell you, I probably have a pretty decent IQ, but I know there are people with higher IQs that don't test as well as I do. One of my strengths is maybe that sort of ability to sort of see the traps as they're set and know how to avoid them. One of the other things is I've always been able to work quickly without sacrificing accuracy. And that's one of the things we try and instill in our students. The ability to work accurately and still work quickly. And that's something that all of you will wrestle with. It's one of the reasons why we have 15 available practice tests. Give you the chance to sort of work on speed and timing and that kind of thing, more than anybody else in the industry. Again, I mentioned earlier that we offer more hours of instruction than our competitors. We offer more lesson booklets and more practice problems. What's great is you don't have to do all of that work, guys. This is not a college class. The only grade you get is the GMAT, and that's all on you. So if you want to just occasionally show up for class, that's fine. If you want to go to class and do that diligently, but not spend much time doing the homework, that's okay too. Although I can say one thing. There is a strong correlation to score increases in the amount of homework and number of practice tests our students do. Now, that score increase, not total score. Some people are just really good natural standardized exam test takers. And if you've already done well on standardized exams in the past, you're probably going to do well on this one. The encouraging thing is we work with people all the time that have struggled with these kinds of exams in the past, but they've mastered our techniques, diligently taken on the homework, diligently attacked the practice tests, and they get these big score increases. That's really fun and rewarding. Help is always nearby. We have more support than any other company. We offer not only email support, which I think all the bigger test prep companies offer. We also have a support line where you can call in and talk with an instructor live on the phone if you have homework questions. So that's nice and unique. We also, as I mentioned, we have the finest instructors. We say sort of, this is 99th percentile and beyond. And again, it's a reminder that it's not enough to simply score in the 99th percentile to teach for us. We only offer jobs to about one out of every eight otherwise qualified instructor candidate. Our basic full course, that's the one that meets two evenings a week for 7 weeks here in Los Angeles. It's the one most people take. It's our sort of standard flagship course. It's $1,500. We also offer a Saturday-only course that meets for 6 hours on a Saturday for seven consecutive Saturdays. It's got a little break in between. It's not ideal. 6 hours in a single day can get to be a little bit much, but for some people, they simply can't do the 7-10 format of our regular class. We also offer a weekend course. It's a little condensed. It's 36 hours, still much longer than the course length of any of our competitors. It's also a little less expensive. It's a verbal weekend, so you go all day Saturday and Sunday on verbal topics. The next weekend, you go all day Saturday and Sunday on quantitative topics. You can also split it up. So if you only want to focus on one or the other, if you already feel like you're going to get all the math questions right and you only want to do verbal, 700, just do that weekend. We also offer private tutoring. It's more expensive, although I think if you shop us around, our private tutoring prices are middle to low. Our course price is a little bit more expensive than our competitors, although we offer a lot more. Our private tutoring, as high as that seems, is pretty standard. That's nice for someone who wants something customized. They really want to work shoulder to shoulder with their tutor to sort of have that person analyze their deficiencies, their weaknesses. Maybe they have a bad strategic approach. Or maybe they just want that customized approach for whatever reason. They prefer that kind of learning environment than to a classroom.
That was Chad Troutwine, co-founder of Veritas Prep. If you're interested in their GMAT courses and want more information, you can visit veritasprep.com. MBA podcaster listeners can receive a $150 discount on any Veritas GMAT course, private tutoring, or MBA admission school package by registering at veritasprep.com with the code POD150. I'm Janet Nakano for MBA Podcaster. Thanks for joining us.